Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have the 2007 Gaspar Bacon Lecture, sponsored by the Department of History in the College of Arts and Sciences. Speaking will be Columbia University Professor of History and Political Science, Ira Katznelson. Professor Katznelson's lecture is titled, The Long New Deal, Reflections on Emergency, Uncertainty, and Moral Ambiguity. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor of History, Julian Zelizer.
Ira is a tremendously important figure, both in the history profession and political science. For younger political historians such as myself, kind of younger, not so much anymore, but I'll still use that. But for my generation of political historians, Ira is a really important source of intellectual, moral support, a mentor, and a role model, both as a scholar and as a professor. He's been a crucial player in the reconceptualization of political history and historical social science in the past two decades. Ira received his PhD in history from Cambridge University. He's been most of his career in political science. Before teaching at Columbia, he was also at the University of Chicago at the New School for Social Research, where he was part of a group of scholars and has continued to be, such as Charles Tilly and Richard Benzel, who for a lot of younger historians, they held seminars and gave shape to a field that's now called American political development. It pushed us to look at how institutions evolve in American politics and how institutions shape social action. Many books and articles, some of his highlights, When Affirmative Action Was White, one of his most recent books, Desolation and Enlightenment, Liberalism's Crooked Circle, Schooling for All, and a true classic in American political history, City Trenches. He has written many articles in journals and also edited many books, including Political Science, A State of a Discipline, which is a great book. If you want to kind of catch up on what's going on in the field. Ira is going to give a talk, The Long New Deal, Reflections on Emergency, Uncertainty, and Moral Ambiguity, from a new book that he's working on. Please welcome Ira.
Well, Julian, thank you very much for that uncommonly gracious introduction. I'm deeply honored to be here at this lecture series, and I've just learned who some previous speakers have been, whom I admire fiercely. So it is a really special treat. Hoping to finish a book on the New Deal, Fair Deal era, and borrowing from the late political theorist Judith Sklar, I'm calling it, at least provisionally, A Liberalism of Fear, the New Deal and the Origins of Our Time. So rather than lecture on finished work, I want to take advantage of this forum and treat it as a kind of workshop to sketch the main lines of argument in that book, to expose its scaffolding, in the hope of getting tough-minded comments, questions, criticism. The first question, of course, is why write about the New Deal at all? Reporting as early as 1934, Charles Beard noted, and I quote, "With astounding profusion, the presses are pouring out books, pamphlets, and articles on the New Deal. And the pace has never slackened. By now, we have abundant thematic histories, biographies of key figures, and studies of public affairs by historians, journalists, social scientists that amply depict virtually every aspect of the Roosevelt and Truman years. So why paint, yet again, the most pictured political landscape in America's 20th century? When Henry James wrote about Venice in 1882, he wrote the following, painted and described many thousands of times, and with an originality of attitude completely impossible, there may be a certain impudence to pretend to add anything. So what indeed is still left to portray about the New Deal? Which purposes and themes, indeed, which originality of attitude might justify yet another portrait? Now, James defended his choice of subject by noting that even if there is nothing left to discover or describe, and I'm quoting, a writer is justified who is himself in love with his topic. And I confess to being in love with this topic ever since my grandmother, when I was very young, and was at her house with my parents discussing the Stevenson-Eisenhower election, 1952, to show you how far back I go. And I remember my grandmother slamming her copy of the Yiddish newspaper, The Forward, down on the dining room table, saying, "Why are you bothering to vote?" to my parents. "They're all pygmies since Roosevelt." And since then, I've been fascinated by Roosevelt and the New Deal. But affection hardly suffices to justify my topic. Now, James was writing, as it turned out, on the eve of a host of revolutions in means of depiction, ranging from Catalan modernism to German expressionism to French cubism. Artists in the late 19th and early 20th century were starting to combine naturalism and abstraction to probe their period's widened, challenging, and dangerous possibilities. Less concerned to discover new facts than alter what and how we observe, their unconventional and tension-ridden ways of seeing brought together affection and hopefulness about what was new with a regretful melancholy and a degree of distance and estrangement. I'm writing a liberalism of fear in that spirit, attempting to compose a likeness that is at once familiar yet not quite known. Neither traditional history nor customary political science. It draws from both to try to offer what Richard Hofstadter once called an analytical history. And I should like to quote yet another great historian to get, quote, just far enough above the details, as Bernard Balin put it in writing about Enlightenment ideas in 18th century America, to see the outlines of the overall architecture and to sketch a line, a principle of reconstruction. More specifically, I want to show how shifts to distance and angles of vision, variations to the relative scale of objects, and changes to the manner in which they are juxtaposed, and adjustments to tools, methods, and materials can bring some vital aspects of the New Deal into view more sharply, and thus make out features that otherwise might remain indistinct. Now, the book I'm writing would have been quite different, I am sure, had I finished it when I had intended a few years back. As great historian of the New Deal, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote shortly before his death, conceptions of the past are permanently revised by the urgencies of the present. I write as a historian to get the story straight, as a political scientist interested in how political mechanisms within a broadly liberal polity work. But I also write as a citizen, trying to understand how democracies can learn to function under severe circumstances marked by apprehension and fear. Focusing on the 1930s and 1940s, I believe, can help deepen our imagination about better and worse possibilities. Anxiety, disillusion, and doubt coursed through that dark and bloody period, motivated by trials not dissimilar from those we currently face. The book identifies how the New Deal renovated Western liberalism under conditions of compressed intensity when the country, and more broadly the Western liberal tradition, were severely exposed to ideological assaults and military threats. I would like to provoke thought about how best to navigate such dangerous currents. This evening, I proceed in four parts. I start with an explication of my title, A Liberalism of Fear. Then, with your indulgence, I will read three abridged versions of three vignettes that appear in the first part of the first chapter of the book, at least as it's currently drafted. Third, I want to outline the main shifts in vantage and perspective that I'm bringing to my topic, and then I want to conclude by summarizing the central arguments that undergird my text. But first, my title. My point of departure, like the dominant historiography on the New Deal, borders on wonderment. It is full of admiration for the New Deal. You'll see I'm already in print with criticisms, but I'm deeply admirous of the New Deal. Under conditions of enormous exigency, the New Deal secured, and I quote now from Judith Schlar, the political conditions that are necessary for the exercise of political freedom. The political conditions necessary for the exercise of political freedom. That, in fact, is how Professor Schlar defined what she called, quote, the one overriding aim of the Western liberal tradition. Her famous phrase, liberalism of fear, the inspiration for the book, is a liberalism geared not to project an ideal or just world, but to protect individuals and groups in the here and now against predatory rulers and human cruelty. It is, as she put the point, a liberalism of damage control. Quote, the freedom it wishes to secure is freedom from the abuse of power and the intimidation of the defenseless, end quote. The New Deal assertively pursued such a liberalism of fear under immensely difficult conditions. What stands out is the institutional reinforcement of a liberalism able to confront cruelty at a time of unprecedented threat and radical uncertainty, when new sets of ideas competed for legitimacy and when the shocks of emergency compounded. Under these conditions, the very nature of the American political system seemed up for grabs. There was talk of dictatorship. As many of you know, just a month before he was inaugurated, Franklin Roosevelt was visited at Hyde Park by the leading journalist in the country, Walter Lippmann, who counseled that he would have to rule by dictatorship. Demagogues abounded. Failure often seemed even more regular than success. There were moments of especially great despair when much seemed lost, as in the early 1930s, when economic devastation seemed impossible to reverse, or in the early 1940s with France, Poland, and a host of other countries captured for Nazi rule, a great deal of the Soviet Union overrun, and Japanese militarism in control of much of the Pacific and the Asian mainland. Even the great victory of 1945 was tarnished by the discovery of the Holocaust, the carpet bombing of enemy cities, and the use of nuclear weapons, developments that undercut comfortable views of human nature and optimism about the fate of the post-war world. Over the span of two decades, moreover, in Asia, Latin America, and Europe, parliamentary government seemed radically insufficient. Many of you know that 1923 is an example. Carl Schmitt, in his pre-Nazi period, was writing about the crisis of parliamentary democracy, arguing that parliamentary governments were simply incapable of addressing the deep problems of the modern world, including modern industrial capitalism and an advanced administrative state. Thus, of the many achievements of the New Deal's liberalism of fear, which include finding a tolerable and legitimate basis for modern capitalism, defeating powerful fascist enemies and empires, democratizing political participation, mobilizing the whole society for military capacity, and making America a less provincial place, arguably the most important of these achievements was the demonstration that liberal democracy, a political system with a legislature at its heart, in fact, could govern successfully, albeit with a great deal of delegation of power to the executive, in order to confront great dangers. In short, as anxiety, disillusion, and doubt deflected American politics and society, as capitalism collapsed, and as liberal democracies across the globe gave way to various forms of dictatorship, the Roosevelt and Truman administrations performed many acts of successful guardianship. On the eve of Roosevelt's inauguration, Benito Mussolini boasted, "All the political experiments of our day are anti-liberal," end quote. In a very tough world, the New Deal risked informal cooperation and formal alliances with illiberal partners, including Mussolini's Italy and Stalin's Soviet Union. And it pushed constitutional processes right to the edge of rights and liberties, sometimes over the limit of rights and liberties, as the U.S. confronted these and other countries when they became military as well as ideological adversaries. Yet in all, while others did not, the New Deal kept liberal democracy going, thus falsifying Mussolini's observation and prediction. Having come to power when every aspect of the status quo concerning how the national state should regulate the economy, organize ties to its citizens, and manage international relations had collapsed, the New Deal responded by reinventing liberalism. Whether liberal democracy could get on successfully was answered by a history of lawmaking that utterly reshaped American institutions and policies. As the legal philosopher Ronald Dworkin has stressed, political liberalism is more than a set of guiding principles. At distinct historical moments, liberal policy takes the form of a particular assemblage of laws, institutions, and regulation that together define liberalism's character and content. The result, in the two decades before mid-century, was a new national state, a novel role for the United States in the world, innovative adjustments to modern capitalism, and transformations to the character and content of citizenship. There is, however, a second and quite different sense in which the New Deal can be assessed as a liberalism of fear. At the very center of the period's Democratic Party stood a powerful segment of American life that intimidated the defenseless and abused power. Below the Mason-Dixon line, organized life in 17 of the country's 48 states functioned with a one-party political system that legally sanctioned racism. And I underscore 17 states, because there were 17 states in the Union that practiced legal Jim Crow, not the 11 who seceded from the Union and not the 13 that typically treated in the congressional literature as the South, but 17. They were the same 17 states, should add, that on January 1st, 1967, on the eve of Loving v. Virginia, the Supreme Court decision that made unconstitutional laws against interracial marriage, had laws against interracial marriage, and they were the same states, minus Oklahoma, which wasn't yet a state, and minus West Virginia, which was part of Virginia, that practiced chattel slavery on the eve of the Civil War. So there has been, in the American experience, from the founding at least until the late 1960s, a consistent, coherent, racialized part of the United States, deeply central to American political development. What Don Fehrenbacher called, for the antebellum period, the slaveholder republic. This region, and I'm now quoting V.O. Key, Jr., the great political scientist, with the most distinctive character and tradition, was confronted not only by, quote, again from Key, adjustment of racial relations on a scale unparalleled in any Western nation, but by poverty associated with an agrarian economy. Bruce Shulman in the room, we owe a debt to him for teaching us about the South in this period, which in places is almost feudal in character, and the long habituation of many its people to non-participation in political life. The South was America's wild card. Gregory Lubert showed in 1991, it was student of comparative politics and political science who tragically died very young, showed in his work on the social roots of fascism in Europe that the fate of liberal democracy frequently hinged on the choices made by leaders, parties, and voters from Europe's least prosperous and most backward regions. Often afflicted by economic volatility, ethnic conflict, demagogic politics, and a sense of isolation from the main currents of modernity, such regions had a very uncertain relationship with modern economic, social, and political affairs. The American South was just such a location. It might have played more than one role in national life, including that of advancing a radically anti-liberal white populism with a family resemblance to European fascism, all the while holding fast to an ideology and institutions of white supremacy. The region nonetheless empowered the New Deal initiatives in Congress by helping secure majorities for the program of the Democratic Party. Persuaded that it could hold on to what its spokespersons blandly called the section's way of life, the South opted in the main to stay inside the ambit of American national democracy. Of course, the region's segregation, restrictions on voting, pervasive intimidation, and climate of violence had a jarring relationship with the country's professed standards and practices. Yet much as the United States had been a slaveholding republic and had allowed the South a wide berth to recreate its hierarchy of color after Reconstruction, the New Deal accommodated racial totalitarianism. This is a subject I've written about in a recent book I call When Affirmative Action Was White. The New Deal's ability to refashion and make capable the liberal tradition to do battle with apprehension, cruelty, and suffering depended, paradoxically and ironically, on harnessing the South to the party's majorities. Without this Faustian bargain, there would have been, could have been, no New Deal. And now, in the spirit, a little bit like work I love, John Dos Passos' novel, great novel, USA, I'm now going to move to three vignettes, and then I'll return to the more analytical story. General Italo Balbo, Mussolini's Minister of Aviation, cut a dashing figure as the daring leader of a squadron of 24 seaplanes that flew 6,100 miles in some 48 hours of flight time in July 1933 from Rome to downtown Chicago via Amsterdam, Londonderry, Reykjavik, the Labrador Coast, New Brunswick, and Montreal. This was not the first such effort. From the start of Balbo's term as undersecretary in 1926 and minister in 1929, he had undertaken to promote mass flights, not only to demonstrate the technological capacities and military prowess of Italy's fascist armed forces, but to display its aeronautica, widely understood to be fascist Italy's most representative, energetic look to the future. Known for his violent tendencies as the head of the Black Shirt Militia of Ferrara after the First World War, he was one of the four paramilitary leaders of the 1922 March on Rome that swept away the liberal state that he, Balbo, disparaged as, quote, a nest of owls. He was widely thought to be the most extreme of Italian fascist leaders when he served as inspector of the regime's militia in the mid-1920s. Yet Balbo was greeted and hailed as a hero in each of the democracies where he touched down in July 1933. When he approached Montreal, a congratulatory message from Berlin arrived on the eve of the German government's decree outlawing any political party but the Nazi Party. Congratulations on your thrilling achievements for fascism. Admiringly, Adolf Hitler. Accompanied by U.S. Army planes in formations spelling Italia, Balbo's air fleet reached Chicago on July 15. Sweeping past the World Fair Exposition of Progress as they landed in eight groups of three in Lake Michigan. Pope Pius, who'd been personally following the path of the flight by placing papal and fascist Italian flags on a large map Balbo had presented before departing, instructed Cardinal Mundelein to confer his blessings. As the news reached Italy, quote, in all the cities, people paraded the streets singing fascist hymns and cheering Il Duce and General Balbo. When the planes came in, 100,000 Chicagoans gathered near Navy Pier, including a rear admiral, the governor, who read warm messages of greeting from the new national administration's Secretary of War and the Secretary of Navy, and the mayor, who compared Balbo to Columbus and proclaimed Italo Balbo Day, and announced the renaming of 7th Street as Balbo Avenue, a name it still has, immediately adjacent to the Hilton Hotel off Michigan Avenue. That evening, a dinner for 5,000 of the city's great and good assembled at the Stevens Hotel, and they rose to offer a fascist salute when Balbo and his squadron entered the room. Chaired by a former American ambassador to fascist Italy and decorated by a huge black silhouette of Mussolini, the gathering heard an invocation by the Bishop of Chicago. They were addressed by Mayor Edward Kelly and the president of Loyola University, who proffered an honorary degree, and as a highlight, a message of salutation was sent by the President of the United States. The next day, Balbo was dubbed the Flying Eagle as he was made an honorary Sioux at the World's Fair. As it turned out, he accepted this honor only reluctantly from Chief Blackhorn, thinking it might sully his representative as a fascist representative of Il Duce. Following a night at a local casino, Balbo and his crew flew to New York, where they were greeted by a crowd of, quote, millions, said the New York Times. On to Washington, and I'll move forward, where basically it simply might be noted that they were, he was and his crew were some of the earliest guests greeted at the White House by Franklin and Eleanor, Italo Balbo. Second vignette is about a figure called Iola Nitkachenko. Surrounded by a city in rubble, the Grand Conference Room of Berlin's Supreme Court building, now the seat of the Allied Control Council, provided the site for the opening session on October 18, 1945, of the International Military Tribunal. The court would soon move to room 600 at Nuremberg's Palace of Justice, where it sat from November 20, 1945, to the announcement of its verdicts on September 30 and October 1, 1946. This unique feature of World War II represented the first time the leaders of a defeated power had been called to task in an international court. Governed by protocols that Britain, liberated France, the United States, and the USSR had adopted in London in August 1945, this cross-national body came to order at 10:30 a.m. Soon it heard capital indictments directed at 22 leading German figures, including Governor General of Poland, Hans Frank, Minister of Internal Affairs, Wilhelm Frick, Gestapo head, Hermann Göring, Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, etc., etc. The tribunal was composed of Lord Justice Geoffrey Lawrence of Britain, Henri Donadieu de Fabre of France, Francis Biddle of the United States, and Iola Nitkachenko of the Soviet Union. Nitkachenko was chosen to preside over the start in Berlin. Dressed in a chocolate red army uniform with gold shoulder boards and green trim, he initiated the proceedings with a statement stressing the defendant's, and I quote, right to counsel. And he underscored the court's rules of procedures shortly to be published, I'm quoting Nitkachenko, relating to the production of witnesses and documents in order to see that the defendants have a fair trial with full opportunity to present their defense. Nitkachenko's prior judicial experience had been accumulated as vice president and divisional military jurist on the panel of the Military Collegium of the Supreme Court of the USSR. This court superintended many trials during the high point of Stalinist terror. It convened to hear one of the most notable cases from August 19 to 24, 1936, in the October Hall of Moscow's Trade Union Building, the pre-revolutionary Nobles Club, decorated with pale blue walls and white Corinthian columns and adorned with a stucco frieze of dancing women. 16 leading communists, including the star prisoners Lev Kamenev and Grigory Zinoviev, who had been amongst Lenin's closest associates, faced accusations of counter-revolutionary conspiracy as members of, quote, the Trotskyite Zinovievite bloc, a group of unprincipled political adventurers and assassins, this is the indictment, striving at only one thing, namely to make their way to power through terrorism. These charges, running to 30 closely printed pages, were submitted by State Prosecutor Andrei Vyshinsky, later the first ambassador of the Soviet Union to the United Nations. They alleged participation in plots to assassinate Leningrad Communist chief Sergei Kirov, who'd been murdered in December 1934, and to kill other leading party figures, including Stalin. This, the first of the three sensational stage-managed trials, produced surreal scenes. Stalin orchestrated the proceedings from behind an opaque screen, occasionally signifying his presence with puffs of smoke from his pipe as the trial unfolded beneath a large slogan reading, "Workers of Moscow, to the mad dogs, a dog's death." No documentation was offered by the prosecution at the trial. No defense was produced by the accused. Each person, without a lawyer, responded to his examination by confession. Third vignette. On May 17, 1948, memorial services were conducted in a joint meeting of the United States Senate and House of Representatives to commemorate the lives and achievements of seven members who had died the previous session. Their number included Democrat Theodore Bilbo, who, following terms in the state Senate as lieutenant governor and twice as governor, had served as a senator from Mississippi from January 1935 until his death in August 1947. After a rose had been placed in a vase in the name of each deceased member, Congressman Everett Dirksen of Illinois, later to go on to greater fame, offered a memorial address, observing that Bilbo, quote, had been a man of deep and abiding convictions. The main tribute was spoken by his junior Mississippi colleague, John Stennis, who identified Bilbo first with, quote, progressive forces and service to the common people. Elected as a populist Democrat, Governor Bilbo indeed had governed on a progressive platform, modernizing finance, supporting a referendum and recall system, expanding public health, redistributing school funds to poorer districts, championing conservation, galvanizing road building. An ardent supporter of Governor Roosevelt of New York for president and an appointee to the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, Bilbo first ran for the Senate in 1934 as a New Dealer, quote, pledging himself to support the efforts of the Roosevelt administration to bring the nation out of the Depression to aid the farmer and the laboring man. After winning the Democratic primary, assuring his election in November, he pledged, quote, to make as much noise for the common people as Huey Long and raise the same kind of hell as President Roosevelt. His platform included support for national governmental control of Federal Reserve banks, cash payments of the veterans' bonus, and wages and hours legislation. To FDR, Bilbo soon proved a faithful friend, said Stennis, delighting in the inspiration and hope proffered by the New Deal. For the first time, Senator Stennis observed, the federal government was turning its attention to the economic problems of the Southland, offering a chance to improve the lot of average citizens. Accordingly, he continued, Bilbo had worked in the Senate, quote, for those measures designed to benefit the great mass of citizens of the United States and not a privileged few. Senator Stennis's, and I should say that when Bilbo ran for re-election, he pronounced himself to be, quote, 100% for Roosevelt, 100% for the New Deal. Senator Stennis's eulogy did not shy away from Bilbo's second main commitment, a fierce avowal of racial segregation and white supremacy. Stennis saluted his colleague, quote, for fighting back with all the vigor of the rough and tumble political fights that had enlivened his political career when measures were brought before the Congress affecting the established customs and traditions of Mississippi and the southern states, end quote. Indeed, from the 1938 consideration of the Wagner von Neuss bill to make lynching a federal crime, to debates in the 1940s about the poll tax, absentee voting by soldiers, including African Americans, and the Fair Employment Practices Commission, Bilbo emerged as the Senate's leading, unashamed crusader for racism. As individuals, the energetic, dapper Balbo, the pale, thin-faced Nitkachenko, and the paunchy, florid Bilbo could not have been more different. But each, determinedly anti-liberal, the servant of an authoritarian regime and a major figure in public life, underscores the willingness, perhaps the necessity, of the New Deal to associate with unsavory Confederates. Under dangerous and uncertain conditions, the Roosevelt and Truman administrations felt compelled to pursue the defense of liberal democracy in alliance with such bedfellows. There can be no doubt that President Roosevelt, as he put it in June 1936, had dedicated his administration to, quote, a war for the survival of democracy, observing, we are fighting to save a great and precious form of government for ourselves and for the world. Over the course of the period of Democratic Party ascendancy that opened with his election in 1932 and closed with that of Dwight Eisenhower two decades later, this war to define and secure political liberalism had multiple facets: efforts to save capitalism from collapse, democratize political participation, defeat Nazi Germany, conquer fascist Italy, quash militarist Japan, and later contain Soviet communism. During those years of bleak uncertainty, the New Deal, including its Fair Deal successor, provided the globe's only major site for experimentation and resistance on behalf of liberal democracy. Notwithstanding, the tales of Balbo, Nitkachenko, and Bilbo remind us that it is a mistake to treat this history in shades of white and black that unfalteringly distinguish liberalism from totalitarianism, democracy from dictatorship, capitalism from communism. During these agitated decades, such clarity proved elusive. As the New Deal sought to remake the Western liberal tradition to secure its legitimacy and extend its domestic and international capacities in order to make it fit enough to survive in a world of predators, it did not, indeed it could not, act without partners with deeply antithetical preferences. The stories of Balbo, Nitkachenko, and Bilbo thus challenge us to confront a largely neglected but vital topic: how the complex relationship of liberalism and illiberalism during the Roosevelt and Truman years gave rise to the world in which we live. To probe this theme, I paint a picture of the New Deal that relies on four key shifts in perspective. The first is temporal. Most scholarship on the New Deal, think of Arthur Schlesinger's three wonderful volumes, William Lichtenberg's still unsurpassed summary, David Kennedy's magisterial Oxford history. This scholarship stops either with the start or the conclusion of the Second World War. Instead, I treat the New Deal as including the Truman administration. Harry Truman, of course, was FDR's last vice president. By considering the full two decades of Democratic rule, a period of unified government for all but the 80th Congress elected in 1946, the range of crises, the character of solutions, the nature of political coalitions, and the contours of the national state as objects of analysis all look different. My second shift in vantage is a refusal to respect the usual historiographic division of labor that separates domestic from foreign affairs. Most important, the book treats the New Deal both comparatively and relationally. Situating the New Deal within a larger global context, it distinguishes how the New Deal confronted deep uncertainty at a time when capitalism and liberal democracy, the central hallmarks of the American regime, were uncommonly insecure. The third move breaks with the most familiar narrative structure of an administration that came to power in circumstances of great anxiety and then, it is said, conquered fear and offered hope to the American people by way of a remarkable legislative set of achievements and the personal charisma of FDR. The fourth alteration in perspective in my book is a move away from a presidency-centered portrait of the New Deal. FDR, of course, was a riveting figure who, not surprisingly, stands at the center of virtually all the literature on the New Deal. Harry Truman has also fascinated historians who wonder how a haberdasher could have become such a firm and often adroit political leader and international player. So I'll conclude by telling you how, with these alterations, I have come to or pose a series of closely linked arguments. And given the time, I'm going to do them in CNN headline news fashion. There are 13. One, the modern liberal tradition is premised, this is not a conclusion, this is the premise of the whole enterprise. The modern liberal tradition is itself premised on the large-scale differentiation of zones of modern life. States, characterized by sovereignty over people and territory, an institutional ensemble and specific normative stories, first. The economy, property, markets, labor relations, trade, civil society, citizens, members and others, associational life, and a global system of states. The liberal tradition was invented as a means to establish rules to govern the relationships and transactions between and among these newly separate zones of state, property, state, society, state, and other states. Based on norms and institutions that concern its central values of consent, rights, pluralism, toleration, and representation, liberalism convenes debate within these parameters about how to construct linkages and transactions joining modern states to the economy, to society, and to the globe. As Dworkin pointed out in that 1978 essay on liberalism I mentioned earlier, there is not one but many possible answers to how policies should be constructed to produce those ties within the boundary conditions established by fundamental liberal norms and institutions. Obviously, the development of mass democracy put new pressures on this process of policymaking. I argue that the New Deal offered the first moment in American history when, under broadly democratic conditions, at least for white Americans, the national state had to manage to create patterns of transaction among and between these spheres through public policy innovation in each of these dimensions simultaneously. And it was the simultaneity of the challenge that marks my second conclusion, because such moments are rare and fateful. It is that marks, in the jargon of political science, the New Deal as a critical juncture, a time of danger and possibility marked by the collapse of the status quo in each of these dimensions. During the New Deal, the status quo had collapsed in each zone of relationship between the national state and the economy, the national state and society, the national state and the global era, a global arena. In such circumstances, producers of policy knowledge gain uncommon capacity, since in such circumstances, there is pressing need for policy ideas in the space, as there was in the New Deal, in the space between illegitimate options like Bolshevism on the one side and delegitimated options like laissez-faire that manifestly had failed on the other. Third conclusion. Presidents Roosevelt and Truman, this is hardly original, this one, were the third step in the argument, were relatively indifferent about which policies to adopt, provided that those policies promised to successfully address the big problems of the day while satisfying partisan imperatives like getting reelected and maintaining legislative majorities. Four, accordingly, it was Congress, within an increasingly permissive judicial climate, that adjudicated in a more fine-grained way among these options, either making the executive branch anticipate their preferences or, by adjudicating amongst options the executive branch was willing to advance or tolerate. Sometimes, as with labor policy in the 1940s, Congress acted decisively against presidential inclinations. Conclusion five. Within Congress, for reasons I've already noted, the pivotal block was that of the Jim Crow Democrats in 17 states with overrepresentation by population in the House of Representatives, because they had small electorates but big populations, and they were overrepresented in the Senate because every state gets two. Of course, they were also overrepresented in seniority because because it was a one-party system. If history plays tricks, this was a big one. Modern liberalism for the United States and for the globe was powerfully shaped by the deepest negation of liberalism inside any Western liberal regime. That is, by these 17 southern states, as well as the District of Columbia, that mandated segregation, managed citizenship along a color line, enforced racism by coercion embedded in law, implemented by police and sheltered by courts. The voice and votes of the Washington representatives selected by the area's restricted one-party political system place the contours of all, I underscore the word all, the key domestic and international features of the New Deal at Southern disposal. It is in this sense that it can be said without hyperbole that the South made the New Deal. Six, in keeping with the priorities and wishes of these representatives, four very distinctive coalitions shaped the renewal of New Deal liberalism. There was an open international coalition with Southern Democrats in the lead as the members of Congress most inclined to open trade, to military assertiveness, and to a widened international role for the United States. Second, there was a civil rights coalition that pitted non-Southern Democrats and Republicans against the South. But with the supermajority rules of the Senate, the South could succeed in blocking that coalition. Third, there was a liberal coalition of all Democrats against Republicans, based on agreements within the Democratic Party amongst the strange bedfellows members of their alliance, on domestic social policy with a social democratic tilt limited by racial and regional considerations. And that's what my When Affirmative Action Was White book is concerned with. And fourth, there was an emergent conservative coalition of Republicans and Southern Democrats focused primarily on labor questions and different understandings of what was at stake when labor issues came to the fore. For Republicans and non-Southern Democrats by the 1940s, what was at stake was where you stood on a left-right continuum. For the Southerners, what was at stake was the future of race relations in the South. It was a different dimension of concern. Conclusion seven, and I'll go more quickly. At the heart of this history of lawmaking was a confrontation with the three most enduring substantive challenges to any liberal order. How to deal with matters of might, that is military force. How to deal with deep inequalities generated as a matter of course by capitalism. And how to deal with issues of membership. Who qualifies to be a liberal citizen? Eight. The congressional coalitions, by managing the boundaries between the liberal and the inherently illiberal, and by crafting new sets of transactions, linking the state to society, to the economy, and to other states, produced a modern American regime that was a hybrid, neither weak nor strong in the sometimes bulky characterization of the literature on state development by Chuck Tilley, Theda Scotchpole, and others, who distinguish between weak and strong states. I think that's entirely wrong in this case. The United States state that was created was strong in every dimension, but differentially so. That is, because of the nature of these coalitions and the role of the South, we had, just to take one contrast, a highly corporatist planning state in the military sphere and a non-corporatist fiscal economic state in the domestic sphere. But both of those states were strong. Nine. This remarkable achievement, which rescued the Western liberal tradition, was shaped and limited by the most deeply illiberal features of the regime. And this argument, which I've already stated some length, gives a view of the relationship between liberalism and race that is distinct from the kind of Hartz-Myrdal tradition, which sees liberalism and race as separate entities and in which liberalism can't be sustained or cannot, racism cannot be sustained in a liberal environment. It's also different from the view of Rogers Smith, which sees racism and liberalism as existing side by side as two separate traditions. Instead, it insists we understand the terms of mutual constitution of liberalism and racism in the American experience. 10. Not only the Strange Bedfellows Coalition, though this was the most enduring, this racist liberal coalition, but also the situational ones of fascism and Bolshevism, as in the cases of Balbo and Nikitchenko, need to be inserted as constitutive parts of the history of the New Deal. 11, I'm almost done. The New Deal solutions put great pressure on constitutionalism, federalism, separation of powers, liberties and rights, as I said earlier, often crossing red line borders, but ultimately keeping the liberal tradition intact. 12, the left of center versions, often defeated at home and often defeated by the 1940s at Southern insistence because the Southerners wouldn't tolerate a national labor quasi-corporatist situation, the left of center versions of the New Deal were exported abroad, especially to the occupied losing powers, Germany and Japan, and thus shaped the modern world in a distinctive way and has created schisms between the American inheritance of the New Deal and the overseas European and East Asian inheritance of the New Deal. Finally, 13, magic number, the world made by the New Deal has endured as the new boundary condition of American liberalism at a time when the United States has come to be one of the globe's two great superpowers, and then has come to stand alone at the top of the hierarchy of wealth and power. In short, this historical, political, and theoretical exploration is devoted to understand how the complex relationship of liberalism and illiberalism during the Roosevelt and Truman years gave rise to the world in which we live. And it's based on the proposition that it might be useful for us today to reflect on the strengths and limitations of how, at that time, the globe's leading liberal democracy navigated emergency, uncertainty, and deep moral ambiguity. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the 2007 Gaspar Bacon Lecture, sponsored by the Department of History in the College of Arts and Sciences. Speaking tonight was Columbia University Professor of History and Political Science, Ira Katznelson. Professor Katznelson's lecture was titled The Long New Deal, Reflections on Emergency, Uncertainty, and Moral Ambiguity. We began with an introduction by Boston University Professor of History, Julian Zelizer. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by Mike Toda and Tim Scove. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.